Good afternoon. My name is Leslie Bilby, and it is my pleasure to introduce panel three on the separation of powers during emergencies. And today I'll be introducing our moderator, Judge John Nalbandian. Judge Nalbandian serves as a United States Circuit Judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. He was nominated and confirmed to that position in 2018. Prior to that, Judge Nalbandian was a partner in the litigation practice group of Taft, Stettinius, and Hollister LLP in Cincinnati, where he served as the firm's lead appellate lawyer and also practiced complex litigation in state and federal courts. Judge Nalbandian was board certified by the Ohio State Bar Association as a specialist in appellate law. Prior to joining Taft, Judge Nalbandian practiced for 5 years in the appellate section of Jones Day in Washington, D.C. Upon graduation from law school, Judge Nalbandian clerked for the Honorable Jerry E. Smith of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in Houston. While in private practice, he also served as a board member of the State Justice Institute, a nonprofit organization established by the federal government to improve the administration of justice in state courts. He served as the president of the Cincinnati Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. He's also been involved in his community as a board member of the Greater Cincinnati Minority Counsel Program and as a board member of the Asian Pacific Bar Association of Southwest Ohio. Judge Nalbandian earned his BS from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and his JD from the University of Virginia School of Law. Judge Nalbandian.
Thank you. Thank you, Leslie. I feel really bad because none of you all are going to get an introduction that long. I'm sorry, because I know we want to get right to it. And I certainly don't think I'm that important. But anyway, thank you, and welcome to everybody. I love being in this room. It's a great setting. It is a little bit disconcerting to see some of the. I know Jennifer Decker, and Lisa Azell is not Jennifer Decker, so it's a little bit odd to see you out of place, Representative Fisher. You know, okay. Anyway, I want to welcome everybody to our panel that's entitled "Separation of Powers During Emergencies." And although the emergency is not specified, I think it's safe to say that we're going to be talking a lot about COVID-19 and the pandemic. As many of you know, and I'll just say briefly, you know, our history is kind of replete with examples of crises that have tested our commitment to the Constitution, to liberty, to the rule of law, while at the same time requiring us and our elected officials, especially, to take unprecedented actions to preserve our health and safety. And to say that COVID-19 has been a test is an understatement. Anyway, so we've got a very impressive group today to talk about separation of powers, the role of the different branches of government in the face of crises, especially this one, and also kind of the battles maybe that the branches have had with each other in dealing with the pandemic. Our plan is to give them each time for opening remarks, followed by some comments and discussion among the panelists, maybe a question or two from me, and then obviously audience questions. So again, the full bios are on the Federalist Society website, but let me briefly introduce them. First, we've got Kentucky State Treasurer Allison Ball. Treasurer Ball is the 38th Treasurer of the Commonwealth and was first elected in 2015, then reelected in 2019. She hails from Eastern Kentucky, Floyd County, right? And I have known Treasurer Ball for 10 plus years, and she was happy to tell me that her father's doing well, and I had a great opportunity to meet him and to hang out with him at one point. So next we have State Senator Robin Webb, who has since 2009 represented Senate District 18, which is Boyd, Carter, and Greenup counties, also in Eastern Kentucky. And she also served previously in the Kentucky House and is an attorney and graduated from the Chase Law School, which is from my neck of the woods. Finally, we have Kevin Gallagher, who serves as counsel in the D.C. office of Wilmer Hale. Kevin has a broad litigation practice that includes First Amendment litigation, which I think we're going to hear a little bit about. I should mention that Kevin clerked on my court for my colleague and friend, Judge Alice Batchelder, and I believe went to my alma mater, the University of Virginia. Wahoo. With that, I'll turn it over to Treasurer Ball to kick us off.
Great. Thank you, Judge. I'll mention one more thing about why this is important to me. Federal Society is always important to me because while I was at UK College of Law, I was the first woman to serve as Federal Society president there. And I know there have been several since then, but I was the one to kick it off. This is an organization that's near and dear to my heart. I always value the time of all of you. Can you hear me okay?
Okay, nutshell. I was Federal Society president at UK when I was there in law school, and I was the first woman to do so. So I love this organization. I believe in it, and it's always just a great time for me to be around like-minded people. I know that iron sharpens iron. We're always better when we're together, and this is always a great day for me. So thanks for being out here with all of us. I get to kick us off, so I'm going to hopefully lay some groundwork for the rest of you to kind of follow up on. But of course, our main thought today is what's the balance of public safety and our structure of government, our rights that are recognized in the Constitution of the United States, and our rights recognized in the Constitution of Kentucky. And particularly for me, Sections 1 and 5 have come into play in this past year. Of course, we know there's a balance. There are times that we have to do things that we wouldn't normally do because of public safety. We all think of the you can't yell fire in a crowded theater illustration. We know there are certain instances where that's in play. But we have to be very careful. Over some time last year, I remember talking to some friends of mine who are missionaries in Albania. And I was asking them, well, what's it like right now for you all in lockdown? And of course, they were in very severe lockdown. And they said, Allison, it's very different from what you have in Kentucky. And this is when we were actually in pretty severe lockdown at that point. And I thought, really, you know, because we can't go to restaurants right now. We can't go to theaters. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. They said, here in Albania, we actually have a tank in front of our door right now. And we're allowed to go outside for an hour and a half once a week. And we have to get a permit to be able to use a vehicle to go to the grocery store. And they actually did missions work, so they were trying to get additional permits, licenses, to be able to get food for other people who were shut-ins and couldn't get out at all. So that is extreme. That's not what we've experienced at all in the United States of America, but we definitely don't want to get there. So what is this balance, and how do we ensure that our structure of government continues and that our rights are protected and that our rights continue? Kentucky is somewhat unique, I think, or at least it's in a different position than other states in the country. For one thing, we have a part-time legislature. We're not unique in that. There are several that do. But our separation of powers are very important. It's historically been noted that we have the strongest separation of powers in the country. Everybody remembers the apocryphal story. I say it's apocryphal. It could be real. Of Thomas Jefferson actually rewriting some ideas that he had to ensure that we had the strongest separation of powers, supposedly learned from experience and took some things here in Kentucky to make it stronger. So we have the strongest separation of powers. And that's interesting. We have a part-time legislature. That means they're silent for a lot of the time. And that emphasizes, I think, why you have some unusual positions for executives. We have a number of executives. There are seven in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. I'm one of them as the state treasurer. And I have always described my job as a watchdog of taxpayer dollars. That's sort of my nutshell description of what I do. It's a great way to describe it when I'm talking to students or chambers or rotaries. But I'm really just summing up a few things when I say I'm the watchdog of taxpayer dollars. Of course, it means like I do the job functionally as I'm supposed to, prevent fraud, things like that. But there's also a separation of powers aspect to it. And a lot of that stems from Rainey v. Stovall, which is a case from the 1960s where there was a Kentucky state senator who was elected from Pike County. I'm from Floyd County, so right next door. He got elected, and then he was elected to, or appointed to be a deputy sheriff in Pike County. So he was elected to his position first and then appointed deputy sheriff. Well, the treasurer at that time was Thelma Stovall, and she was always known as someone who pushed the limits. Some of you know her story about when she was lieutenant governor and kind of took the reins of the governorship while the current governor was gone. Well, when she was treasurer, she made sure that she pushed the limits as treasurer as well. And so she challenged whether or not she should pay that state senator his salary as a state senator because he was actually working in a conflicting job as a deputy sheriff. And so that went to court, and how it was resolved really isn't important right now. But what is important is I want to point out is this is the Constitution fixes a policy with respect to public expenditures, which surely must infuse the code of conduct of constitutional officers, particularly those charged with control of public funds. The designation by the legislature of certain specific duties and responsibilities of the treasurer did not extinguish the implied obligations of the office. In our opinion, the treasurer may properly, acting in good faith, act upon a substantial constitutional ground, raise a question for judicial determination concerning the legality of a claim upon the treasury. So that's what has always been in the back of my mind is my job as treasurer, that watchdog to protect the Constitution. And I didn't really expect that it would come up very often while I was in office, but surprise, surprise, it came up in a big way last year for me when began to hear reports about the governor's executive order to close down churches being enforced by uniformed KSP and that people were being threatened with arrest and pretty severe actions were being taken to prevent people from going to church. And my office looked into it to determine, was this happening in a wide-scale way? Was it just sort of a one-off that happened by some overzealous KSP up in Bullitt County? What was this? So because of that watchdog role, that protection role, I've looked into it across the Commonwealth. We actually sent open records requests. So we did this in probably the most basic way you could do it. We sent open records requests across the Commonwealth to certain counties and asked them some questions that covered actually a pretty limited period of time. It was just March through June. So it covered Easter significantly, but it covered time before and time afterwards, to find out, was this happening? And we found out that, yes, it was indeed happening. We reviewed about 10,000 documents, and like I said, it came from all over the Commonwealth of Kentucky, so we saw that KSP truly were being directed by the governor himself to stop people from attending church. And, of course, we all value the First Amendment, the free exercise of religion, free association, and also the Kentucky Constitution, Sections 1 and 5, which protect that and even actually go a little bit further. So I was concerned from my perspective that this was happening, and I issued a report that I made in testimony before the General Assembly to act in that watchdog role, make sure that this never happened again, that constitutional rights were not infringed again. And that report showed that there were targeted monitoring of churches by local health departments at the direction of state officials. There was coordinated surveillance of churches by KSP, which included officers remaining posted outside churches, where churchgoers were instructed that they faced the threat of repercussions, including criminal penalties and quarantine orders for their attendance. There was also a disdain shown by the administration for sincerely held religious beliefs of Commonwealth citizens, and enforcement distinctions drawn between the administration for protests based on subject matter of those protests. So that was the summary of what I reported to the General Assembly at that point in time. Was followed up then a little bit later, right around Thanksgiving, when the governor issued an executive order closing down all the schools in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, including specifically religious schools. Flowing out of my work from that report, I then filed an amicus in Danville Christian, and I believe you're going to discuss that in more detail. A lot of these cases are going to be discussed in more detail than what I'm going to do. I'm just going to give you sort of my touch points with these cases. We filed an amicus just because of that role, that watchdog. Based on my report, I did figure out that there was a lot of targeted religious groups. They're being treated differently from similar groups. And particularly if you started to look into it, we noticed that there were very few cases among private schools. In fact, in some instances, there were zero, none at all, which showed that they were doing good work in that area, and that there was a red zone designation. If you were in a red zone, then you couldn't have school during this period of time, and it was entirely too strict. In one county in particular, I've got Clinton County here, if you had three current cases of COVID, then you couldn't have school. So it was a pretty serious shutdown of all those schools at that period of time. Which is why we then jumped in to make sure that didn't happen. And it went to the United States Supreme Court, which I'm going to let you deal with a little bit more fully. But I would say to you that one thing that guided all of that, of course, is separation of powers. But what guided it mostly was the Constitution of the United States and the Constitutions of Kentucky. And I would argue that we need to make sure that we are protecting the Constitution of the United States, we are protecting the Constitution of Kentucky. And I had a great quote from Judge Van Tatenhove, who I know was here earlier and may walk in again in a minute, from Tabernacle Baptist Church, when he said, "It would be easy to put the Constitution on the shelf in times like this, to be pulled down and dusted off when more convenient. But that is not our tradition. Its enduring quality requires that it be respected even when it is hard." And I fully believe that, and I believe that in my role as treasurer, that it's my job to make sure that the Constitution is protected. Once Danville Christian Church was heard, some of you may remember that the Supreme Court determined it was moot because by that point in time, they were already about to go back to school. I think it was 2 days before school was about to go back in session, so the court wasn't ready to deal with that. But there was a great comment by Justice Gorsuch in his dissent in that, and he said something I want to point out to you because I think it guides what we're talking about here. Courts have a broader equity at stake here, too. In their struggle to respond to the current pandemic, executive officials have sometimes treated constitutional rights with suspicion. In Kentucky, state troopers seeking to enforce gubernatorial orders even reprimanded and recorded the license plate numbers of worshipers who attended an Easter church service, some of whom were merely sitting in their cars listening to the service over a loudspeaker. Recently, this court made it clear it would no longer tolerate such departures from the Constitution, and it cites the Cuomo case, which I think you'll probably go into in a little bit more. We did so in a case where the challenged edict had arguably expired, explaining that our action remained appropriate given the governor's claim that he could revive his unconstitutional decree any time. That was the proper course there, as I believe it is here. I would not leave it in place yet another potentially unconstitutional decree even for the next few weeks. So again, there's a strong appetite for protecting the Constitution right now. And I want to point out that I think this is critically important because I think we're beginning to see even more in the media and news coverage, even people who are supposed to be experts in this area, a bit of a disdain for the Constitution, a bit of the disdain for the structure of government that we have. And some of that is being spurred on by the argument that we have to protect public safety. Of course, we have to protect public safety, but we also have to make sure that we ensure our structure of government, we ensure our protections under the government. New York Times recently had an article by Maureen Dowd called The Supreme Court versus Reality on October 10th of this year. And she was arguing that the court has become so political that we really don't need to look at it as a separate branch anymore and protect it and respect it the way that we have because, let's just be honest, it's political. And in that, she quoted Adam Liptick, and I really want to make sure I get this quote right for you because I think you'll be interested to hear it. Adam Liptick, just recently in the Daily Podcast, which is the New York Times podcast, said that the reasons justices are so sensitive now, meaning to political, the argument they're political, is that the authority of the Supreme Court, it's a little hard to know where it comes from. Sure, it's in the Constitution, but they don't have an army. They don't have the power of the purse. It's not entirely clear why we do what the Supreme Court tells us to do. Now, I find this to be scary because without respect for our structure of government, without respect for the separation of powers, the whole thing can fall apart. And I want to leave you with, because I'm running out of time, I had more I wanted to say, I want to leave you with a quote from Hamilton. In letter number 3 to the American Daily Advertiser on August 28th of 1794, if it be asked, what is the most sacred duty and the greatest source of our security in a republic? The answer would be an inviolable respect for the Constitution and laws, the first growing out of the last. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Treasurer Ball. And then I think next we're going to hear from Senator Webb.
Thank you. Thank you all. And it's an honor to be here today with such an esteemed panel. And this particular room, Judge, kind of gives me flashbacks as Representative Fisher. We came in together, the General Assembly, back in 98. And back then, the legislature was far more silent. We were having that discussion earlier because we met every other year. So we are now at annual sessions, and we do far much more damage now than we ever did. But again, I'm happy to be here. And as a perspective of an elected for the last 20-something years in both chambers, and having withstood a couple disasters outside of COVID, including floods and ice storms and those things which historically affect my district wherever I am. So I've got a little bit of skin in the game through the years, and I'm also old enough to remember, as some of you are, about how Kentucky was once had a very strong executive in the form of a governor, and the legislature pretty much did what they were told. And I remember those days and had the, and then in law school, had the privilege to work for the House leadership in the 80s when the legislature, after the Brown administration, was getting some new legs and flexing their muscle a bit and creating a more autonomous branch of government and actually fulfilling their role in the separation of powers. So I've been very, which I always have been an advocate of, and you know, my job here to me is not that political because, you know, I am a criminal defense lawyer and I make no apologies for that because that to me is a constitutional lawyer and I'm very proud of that. And it keeps me close to the Constitution, both of the United States and Kentucky. And that's the way I try to look at bills here. And I've had even colleagues say, oh, we know that might be unconstitutional, but the court can decide that. That kind of grates on me on several levels because I take two oaths not to do that. And I know that if it wasn't for difference of opinion and interpretation, that none of us probably would have jobs. But, you know, you have to balance that when you're reviewing legislation and you're here from a policy standpoint in not only emergencies but in everything that we do. And that's not always easy. But, you know, and then having not the strong executive and like Hamilton, you know, he was for a strong executive and more of a centralized government, but was also a defender of liberty, personal liberty. So my son made fun of me because in the play Hamilton, I was the only person that clapped when Jefferson came out. But but he said, Mom, you're the only one clapping. Oh, well, you know, I'm a little more Jeffersonian. But we've got, again, the balance. We got to remember that in the U.S. Constitution, you know, the executive was stronger than in the Articles. So that carries forward. And there's a reason for that, whether it's, you know, inability to govern by counsel. Because if we had to govern the state based on the General Assembly, you know, I don't know how that would go. And the governor does have the call for a special election. That's kind of telling, along with what's already been referenced about us being a part-time legislature. So that kind of gives me some guidance and where to stay in my lane somewhat, notwithstanding being a watchdog as well on the policy side, especially in executive orders and administrative regulations. I think we can do, always have said we can do a better job with that, and my votes kind of indicate that, and sometimes my votes are all over the board because I try to look at a constitutional issue. And there are many provisions in that particular bill that, with public protection, with the balance, separation of power issues, and you got to make a decision. You know, you've got to vote yay or nay. I don't pass much. Some people do. But, you know, so you've got to balance that prioritization in your mind and go with the best that you can do. And I think most of the members of the General Assembly certainly does that. And you know, we have the ability to send messages to the governor like we did. But we look at the progression of executive power just in the past few decades, and when the legislature was standing on its land legs, so to speak, and getting stronger, we also empowered the executive branch in many ways in emergency management. You can look at the statutes and the creation of the departments and in the ability of what they had to do. You know, and we got to looking at this bill in 19 thinking, whoo, that's kind of scary, some of these provisions that the previous General Assemblies had let. But, you know, like anything else, it's a kind of a great experiment sometimes, an omnibus piece of legislation, and you kind of see how it goes thinking, well, especially now, oh, we'll be back next year, we can reel that in. So you know, in application, the General Assembly kind of enabled and empowered the governor even while their power was growing in ways of emergency management and in dealing with these emergencies. So you have to look at from the historical perspective, and sometimes when you're trying to reconcile the constitutional compliance with the statutory authority, as the courts know, it's not always easy to do in the separation of powers issue. But certainly, you know, we do the best we can. I think that's the main thing. And as a part-time legislature, and I don't think there's many of us that would like to see that change, because I feel it's important for me to be in the courtroom and in my community and practicing law and involved in my constituency and then throughout the state. I practice law throughout the state, so I just don't have a snapshot of my district. Is important for us to bring that experience and what we learn out there to what we do here in the realm of policymaking. So, you know, sometimes you have to bear with us, and sometimes the courts do have to decide because it's especially in this last couple years in the special session, trying to be responsive and have a comprehensive answer. You know, you can concentrate on the COVID phenomenon and hope that it's an anomaly and it won't happen again. So you craft these laws to fit this picture, but then the next time it may be something else. So you've got to be careful in getting too specific with your disaster, and that's what my caution was and continues to be. And you got to take the politics out of it. I want anybody that's governor to have what the tools they need, whether it's in the budget. I've worked under governors of both parties. I have no problem working with executive branch. Well, I have had a few problems, but usually with my own party. But anyway, you know, you've got to take the politics out of the constitutional application of separation of powers and keeping everybody in their lane for this thing to work. And that's what sometimes we fail to do because of ideology and politics and personal agenda. So that's never good when you're dealing with constitutional issues and the actions of our branches of government. So, you know, we want to hear from you. We all want to hear from you. We're accessible. We want your ideas. We want, mark up that. We lawyers are good at marking things up and sending them back. So if you see a bill, mark it up, send it to us. We want to make informed decisions, and those of us who are attorneys, I think, do have a little bit of advantage on these issues, and a lot of other members look to us for guidance. So feel free to communicate with us along those lines, and let's pray we don't have to go through this situation again. Thank y'all.
Thank you, Senator Webb and Mr. Gallagher.
Thank you. So you heard from kind of the executive perspective, legislative perspective. So I'm not a judge, but I'll give you the judicial legal perspective in that I do practice as an attorney. You may be thinking, who is this guy who doesn't have honorable next to his name, is from Philadelphia and works in D.C.? Why is he here with us in Kentucky? Well, we at WilmerHale found ourselves with a little cottage industry, I like to call it, of church COVID cases. We did about 5 over the course of the year and a half that we've all lived through, 3 of which were in Kentucky for whatever reason. We found ourselves in this hotbed of COVID litigation. And so I will give you just a rundown of the cases. Treasurer Ball mentioned some of them, but I'll give you a little bit more detail as far as our perspective on them and some of the issues at play, and then try to bring it back to the topic at hand, which is the separation of powers, although I think you'll see it throughout my talk on it. So our first case was we got called by a church the week of Easter of 2020 to represent them in order for them to be able to do a drive-in church service. The mayor of Louisville had said that drive-in services were not going to be okay and was threatening penalties and contact tracing and things of that nature. And so they wanted us to bring a lawsuit in order for them to be able to meet safely, social distance. Even at that time, we knew those concepts. And so we brought the lawsuit. A team of us stayed up basically all night, Thursday into Good Friday, to put together the papers, file the complaint, and then a motion for a temporary restraining order. And then we got assigned to Judge Justin Walker, who some of you heard from if you went to the Young Lawyers panel. And the next day, so Saturday before Easter, he issued a great opinion allowing our client to meet for a drive-in service on Easter. I think Phil put it, he saved Easter that year. So that was very exciting. And some time passed, and the restrictions were, it was a little bit up in the air. So drive-in services are now okay, thanks to Judge Walker, who just walked back in. And we now had a Sixth Circuit opinion from Judges Sutton, who you heard from this morning, McKee, and Judge Nalbandian, that said that drive-in services were, in fact, on the Sixth Circuit level, okay constitutionally, and sort of suggested that now in-person services were the next frontier. And so we brought a lawsuit on behalf of Tabernacle Baptist Church in the Eastern District of Kentucky I believe Treasurer Ball quoted from that decision from Judge Van Tatenhove, and we got the right for them to meet in person for church services going forward, and something that was sort of a surprise but was very nice was that the judge made it apply to the entire state of Kentucky, so all churches were able to meet. And sort of interestingly, and again dovetailing with the theme of separation of powers, is that you know, these judicial challenges really did affect things from the executive branch, because the next day the executive branch changed the restrictions and allowed all in-person church services to go forward. It was sort of a "you can't fire me, I quit" type of thing, because he'd already been ordered to do that, but now he was the governor was saying these can go forward. You know, they're sanctioned by the executive branch, and so you know, in at least for Kentucky, we had succeeded in many ways. In-person church services were allowed to go forward, and so we at WilmerHale started doing other things. We did a case in the District of Columbia for Capitol Hill Baptist Church, which is interestingly my my church that I go to, I'm a member of, and we won a temporary restraining order for outdoor services there. The District of Columbia wasn't even allowing outdoor services at the time. And then it was only around Thanksgiving, as Treasurer Ball mentioned, where we got a call again, because the Governor Beshear had put in a new executive order about private schools being able to meet in person. So we brought the Danville Christian Academy to the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, the court sort of sat on it for about 2 weeks and then basically said this is moot because the executive order is expiring tomorrow. You know, we would have liked a decision before that, but that's neither here nor there, I suppose. And so one of the things that was interesting is that in between when we had brought our case in D.C. and then when we brought the case for Danville Christian Academy up to the Supreme Court right around Thanksgiving is when the Supreme Court had sort of finally weighed in the Roman Catholic Diocese v. Cuomo case and had basically codified what many of us had been arguing along the way. I mean, obviously we weren't the only ones doing these cases. There were people around the country doing great work on this. And so we were able to leverage what finally had a five-person majority to make some arguments that we thought were pretty compelling on behalf of a religious school in Kentucky. And so from there, I think over the last year and a half, over the last year, basically 2021, in many ways, the Supreme Court has sort of made the playing field pretty favorable for churches. I think in many ways, churches have been able to succeed on their arguments. I mean, the Tandon case that came out a few months ago and the Cuomo case have allowed churches to basically make arguments that as long as, you know, the Home Depot or the Kroger or whatever is open and allowing people inside, you need to be having those same restrictions apply to, or lack of restrictions, I guess, apply to churches as well. And so it's been a very interesting year and a half of free exercise litigation. I'm happy to talk more about that either in Q&A or you know, after the panel. But I think the separation of powers point here is that you know, in many ways, the executive branch in Kentucky and other places where we were bringing these lawsuits were doing things that we believed were unconstitutional. Right? There's the check. Some of the executive. I know Kentucky's very unique in that regard. The governor, I'll say. Is that okay? Okay. Thank you. The governor had been doing certain things that we believed were unconstitutional. And so we, as sort of advocates to the court, were trying to use the judicial branch as a check on those actions. And thankfully, in many ways, we were able to succeed you know, kind of across the board, because I think we were right in that this is overstepping, you know, the Constitution. And so I think for those of you law students, clerks, I know we have a lot of those folks in the room. I'm not that much more senior than you, so hopefully this perspective is worthwhile. But I think these are worthwhile endeavors to do. I mean, even folks going to a firm, I don't do just pro bono constitutional litigation 24/7, but make time to do things that make a difference in this world. I mean, this sort of fell in our laps in many ways, and I'm very thankful for it. But at the same time, like, seek out opportunities to make a difference in your community and, you know, for the country if you can, to the extent you have those opportunities. So with that, I'll let others talk.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. That's good advice. Good advice. The other two have any, I'll open it up to you all for comments on anything that you heard. Otherwise, I can ask you a question or two. Or...
Go ahead, ask.
Okay. Are you sure?
Yes.
All right. I'm going to ask you, well, let me give you the macro level question. And this one has come up. We're talking about separation of powers, and also when we throw federalism in there too, because it's kind of another mechanism to diffuse power, right? We have kind of the atom of sovereignty was the analogy, and it's been split up. We have state, federal, we have executive, legislative, judicial. There are some who have suggested that although that system works well, the one time that it really struggles is in an existential crisis like this one, when everyone really needs to be pulling the oar the same way, or whatever, however analogy you want to use. And that separation of powers really doesn't work if you're trying to fight something like a COVID-19. Do you all have a response to that?
I'll weigh in first. Yeah, it's a good question, and I remember being asked that when I testified last year about the church surveillance. And one point that I made then, and I think it's really worth noting today, is that the founders understood existential crises. They were well familiar with endemics. Actually, if you review history, and I did not realize this until this year and into last year, George Washington had several smallpox endemics that occurred while he was leading the army in the Revolutionary War. And there was one instance when Hamilton, Jefferson, and Washington all had to leave Philadelphia. They had to leave the capital because of an outbreak of yellow fever. And I always think it's so interesting that while they lived through this and they fully understood it, there was no asterisk in the Constitution that said, as long as there's no existential crisis, as long as there's no pandemic, there's no endemic, these things are true. And I really think that needs to be a grounding thing for us. This is not new to our time. These things have always existed. And the founders, you know, thought these things through when they drafted the documents that they drafted. So I think that's something that's worth remarking. Also, I would say, once you start giving up your structure of government, once you start giving up federalism, once you start giving up constitutional rights, it's very, very hard to pull those things back. And there's always a temptation to relinquish those things, to let those things go when you're in a crisis. I think that's why it's so important that you make these decisions when you're not in crisis. You figure out what your first principles are. You're guided by those things. In our instance, this would be the Constitution. That's our guiding document, our guiding first principles. And we live by those when we're in crisis because we've thought them all through when we're out of crisis.
And it is harder for everybody. I think this was the first time that all 50 states were together and declared emergency crisis in the nation's history, perhaps, all 50 together at once. And I think you've got to acknowledge the structure of the federal government, and it's changing through the years, as well as returning things to the state, which is a good thing. I'm for that. But in so doing, and the funding that goes with it, it's a lot harder in my neck of the woods. And Allison's, it's G and Hall. If you got two mules, you got a G and Hall. It's a lot harder to do when the federal has relinquished the roles historically that it has sometimes. So that creates a challenge, but that it's a desired thing, but it does create more levels of challenge that way in getting everybody together. And then the Kentucky Constitution, in some areas it's already been acknowledged, and we know, it's a U.S. Constitution plus. So, and you've got other states with different degrees that the U.S. Constitution, and we're not all the same, and that's a good thing. But it does create challenges for those of us making policy and making decisions and reconciling. Even with, I live in an area that borders Ohio. My district borders Ohio and West Virginia, so we weren't always on the same page, whether it's Tennessee or whatever. And that came to light more than ever when you've got a district in a tri-state area. It was hard to even know what was going on when you went to the store, your daily routine, what state was doing what, and the incidences were different, the reports were different, the rules were different. But it's challenging. It's challenging for the executive branches, and it's challenging for the policymakers too, to try to be consistent and find out what's working.
The only thing I would add is, you know, one of the things that we dealt with very early on and continually through these cases was the Jacobson v. Massachusetts case, which many of you are probably familiar with, that at least people on sort of the other side of our cases was often saying should give a blank check to governments to be able to, you know, act out their authority during an emergency. And so part of the problem is that this emergency dragged on, right? We were months and then now a year plus into it. And then the other issue is that Jacobson, and I think various judges pointed this out, and then Justice Gorsuch, you know, wrote about it in one of the Supreme Court cases on this, was that Jacobson didn't really deal with a constitutional issue on the other side. And so we have a situation where pandemic emergency power is running up against constitutional rights and what needs to win out there. And I think most of us in this room, and thankfully a lot of the judges who deal with these cases, agree that the Constitution needs to win out. I mean, there's not a pandemic exception to the Constitution. And so in order for our Constitution to mean anything, we often think of, you know, protection of speech. In order for it to mean anything, it needs to be applied for very unpopular speech, right, or very minority speech. I think in many ways the Constitution also needs to survive a pandemic and for it to be, you know, something that is worthwhile and that we, you know, can keep around. And so I think in many ways I've been very encouraged to see the way that folks have rallied around the fact that the Constitution, you know, still applies even in the midst of really difficult circumstances. And like Senator Webb said, and others have said, it's a difficult set of issues. I'm not trying to say that I would want to make these decisions that people in the executive branch or the legislative branch are making. But at the same time, when they're impeding our constitutional rights, there needs to be a check on that.
Kevin, let me ask you a question that was kind of dovetails with our opening speaker, Judge Sutton, who's obviously written a book about state constitutions and using state constitutions. As a litigator looking at individual rights issues, did you all look at state court? Was that an option? Why or why not?
It's a good question. We did not look in state court. Honestly, the 24 hours when we filed the first lawsuit is a little bit of a blur, and so I cannot tell you why we filed in federal court as opposed to state court. We brought Kentucky constitutional claims as well, and so you know, I think the fact that we had federal claims and we thought we might end up with a great judge such as Judge Walker, we thought we might bring it in federal court, but it is something, at least not in state court, but for state claims, we did look into that, and like Senator Webb has been saying, and Treasurer Ball, the Kentucky constitutional protections in many ways were even more robust, and so we thought at the very least, you know, we would have good claims there as well.
Let me ask you, and I want to open it up to the audience here in a second, but let me ask you all another question about kind of the role of maybe state and local, or not state, but local, like county and other officials in this. We've seen some, maybe in other states, some, you know, we've got vaccine mandates and other things that school boards and others have been, and then you have a governor or maybe someone else who disagrees. That's, in a way, it's kind of a mini federalism issue, I guess. But I'm wondering if you might address kind of local politics and local responses and vis-a-vis the state.
Well, just like the issue on the national level, I mean, it's pretty divisive in my communities anyway. It's pretty much a mixed bag, and it's certainly. You know, I've been an advocate for local control and local school board decision makings and how each school handles the days off or the remote learning. We've got 120 counties of diverse region, and what works for my district in Ashland, even with numbers of COVID, may not be the incidence or the experience in Paducah. I wanted to give the local boards the flexibility to do that, and I think that's why we elect school board members. And the same thing with the mask mandate. I took a lot of heat over that, and it was about 50-50. But, you know, the bottom line is I want to be consistent, and I had faith in the local school boards to make those decisions. I think it's important, and I think that's why we have the structure government that we have, and that I wasn't passing the buck on my decision-making. I was just giving it to the people that were elected to make those decisions, in my opinion. And we'll continue to, but it's very divisive and a mixed bag, and I don't know that that's going to improve. So as a policymaker, you just can't stand outside or poll it or see how the wind's blowing. You've just got to look at the Constitution and look at the structure of government and see where it fits the best.
You know, I think it goes back to making sure that everybody is doing the job they were put there to do, and I mean that in more of the structure of what they're supposed to do. You staying in your lane, and I think it's very important that policymakers are the ones who are making policy. And we're talking about a local level. Some of them are going to be policymakers, and some of them are executive and a variety of other positions. But I think it is critically important that we keep policymakers making policy and not have an executive governing by fiat, because then you don't have someone who's had that measured way of doing things, and they've had to talk to a lot of people, like you've just talked about, Robin, of how you've had to talk to a lot of your local constituents to figure out what it is they're telling you, what they're experiencing. So I think that just emphasizes, again, the importance of policymakers are the ones who are making policy.
If I could say one more thing.
And after two decades, I've used this a lot, but it's like, we're going to give you the flexibility to do your job, and if you don't, we'll be back in January. We don't want to micromanage it to do it for you, but we can as a legislature.
All right. Do we have any questions from the audience?
That'd be a great question for Thomas Jefferson. But I do think there's a quote here that's good for that. In Brown v. Barclay, which is a case that's often referred to when you're dealing with what you're allowed to do in state government, there's a quote here from the Kentucky Supreme Court that said, "As the governor is the supreme executive power, it is not possible for the General Assembly to create another executive officer or officers who will not be subject to that supremacy." So the governor is the supreme executive power. But it definitely has the prerogative of withholding executive powers from him by assigning them to these constitutional officers who are not amenable to his supervision and control. And I think that just reflects that strong separation of powers that we have. And I think we see that it's good to do that. When we're in instances of crises, like we've been in the last 2 years, when you want to have some checks and balance, particularly if you've got a state legislature that's part-time, and it takes a while to get into the court system. You're not always going to have your case litigated and taken care of quickly. So our Kentucky founders, Thomas Jefferson being supposedly among them, decided that we were best protected, we had best separation of powers, best checks and balance if you have a little bit of diffusion of power. And of course it's subject to the General Assembly. They're the ones who lay out what it is you can do, besides what the Constitution says, which also comes from them originally.
Great.
Thank you.
It's a really good question. I feel very inadequate to respond to that, but I will try. So I should mention that we certainly at Wilmer Hill did not do this alone. On all the cases that I mentioned, we work with First Liberty Institute, which is a First Amendment advocacy group, and then also worked in conjunction with the Attorney General Office here. So we weren't alone. But sort of to your question, I think a group like First Liberty and others like it are very good at sort of finding clients, right? I don't know that we would have known about On Fire Christian Center in Louisville, Kentucky, if we hadn't heard from them. And so I think there are a lot of groups on sort of both sides of the aisle, for lack of a better term, that are doing good work of like mobilizing folks to use your term in order to fight for their rights, right? I think as a society, we are certainly very litigious, and so that, I think that kind of dovetails with what we see. It's good for those of us in the law field. It's a good business to have. But I think that folks are, especially during a pandemic or other situations like that, more willing to seek out legal avenues. I will say, to what Senator Webb was saying, there's often other ways to go about things, right? To try to advocate for change in local channels, community meetings, things of that nature. So you don't always need to go to litigation. But when Easter Sunday is 2 days away and your community meeting is not happening because of COVID, there's really only so much you can do, right? And so I don't know that I can speak to this entire country about whether people are mobilizing, but it certainly seems that way. I mean, I think you read about these cases all the time. And I think there's always need for good lawyers. I don't know your situation, if you're a clerk or a student or currently out there, but I think there's always a need for folks to, take up various causes, because that's people need representation.
Any other questions? No? Okay. Okay, I take that's the classic Federal Society question right there. Okay, help me thank our panel. Thank you all.